Pursuing sexual pleasure, just for the sake of eroticism, is empty and it's selfish. And I lose out on the beauty that sex is.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
I am very much enjoying these talks that we've been having on sexuality. It's been fun for me to be able to talk a lot about things that I usually don't get to talk about in a very public arena. I get to talk about sexuality in my counseling office, but don't get to share a lot of what I've learned and a lot of what I feel is really important to people generally. And Jack, as I read literature, and I don't quite honestly have lots of time to read these days with three kids and a job, but the reading that I do, I'm very dissatisfied with what I see in the literature regarding sexuality. And so I like being able to talk about it and maybe give some new information to people.
Maybe we shouldn't go here, but what are you seeing in the literature? What are they saying that is so dissatisfying?
Well, so often it's just kind of nuts and bolts. Oh. It talks a lot about how to be sexual, what do you do, how do you attract somebody, what are some of the mechanics of being sexual, and it feels dry and one-dimensional to me, as opposed to coming out of sexuality, coming out of a relationship that's committed and that's full of depth and meaning and value. And it seems to me that that's the context in which our sexuality really gets played out to its fullest. And in the literature, it talks a lot about just being sexual apart from being in relationship and being sexual. Hmm. As though it's just a function that we do. And so that's one aspect that I at least have picked up a lot on. Mm-hmm. And it makes it dry.
Yeah.
Kind of feels like a prune to me as opposed to a real juicy peach. Mm-hmm. And long time ago in Christian literature, I read a lot about how do you just be sexually alluring to your husband. You know, what are the ways that you dress or you act? And so even from that Christian perspective, at least from years ago, it was, I think, very, very far off the mark of the beauty that we've talked about here with sexuality. I think particularly last time that we spoke, we talked a lot about the beauty of sexuality. But today we wanted to talk about sensuality. Mm-hmm. So will you start us out, Jack, and define that for us?
Well, what I would mean by sensuality, I think this is what the New Testament means by sensuality, are attitudes and perceptions and behaviors that come out of a mistaken notion of what our sexuality is for and what its primary purpose is. We talked about in the past and we reviewed last week that the primary purpose of sexuality is as a kind of language, a very, as you described last week, beautiful language that we use to express our commitment to one another and our valuing and treasuring one another. That it's this beautiful language that God has given us, not a verbal language, a nonverbal language, the language of my body rather than the language of my words. But its primary purpose is to communicate that commitment and that valuing, that mutual valuing and treasuring one another. There's another aspect to sexuality, though, and that is that it's pleasurable. It's pleasurable at two levels. We've talked about this. It's pleasurable at just purely the physical, biological level, arousal and orgasm. It's pleasurable in that sense. It's also pleasurable psychologically. and the psychological pleasure is closer to the primary purpose of sexuality. Namely, it's pleasurable because somebody treasures me, somebody values me, somebody thinks that I'm special.
And it's a way that I can say that to another person, which is really valuable. When my words become limited, I can use my body to also say, I treasure you, I value you, I love you, you're important to me.
Right. So sensuality is when we take either the physical, usually it's the physical pleasure of arousal and orgasm, and we treat my sexuality as if that's what it's for. And that becomes the kind of primary driving function behind my sexuality.
And that's exactly what I was talking about just a few minutes ago when we started the program, was that that's what I read about in the literature a lot.
Okay,
we just take
right.
that one-dimensional side of sexuality and make that all that it is.
Right, right. Exactly. And that's also what the books of the 70s and Christian literature on sexuality did as well. They turned sexuality into, they honored it as something sensual and only sensual, and said, go for it. You know, be as sensual as you can in the name of Christ or something like that. And that's a mistake. That's a huge mistake. It's a perversion of what sexuality is.
That we only take this one side.
Yeah, not that there's a dimension of the sensual in sexuality. I mean, that would be absurd to deny that. Sure, it's an aspect of what happens in sexuality. It's an aspect of what sexuality is, but it's not its purpose. It's not its primary role. It's not the driving force behind what we are to do with our sexuality. And if we make it that, then we are perverting God's design. We are distorting what my sexuality is and the place it should have in my life when we do that.
And Jack, I think that's where a lot of what I read about today in some of the psychological literature or the modern day non-Christian literature that I have read is that they really do land on this whole area of sensuality only. And from it, they are encouraging all sorts of fantasy, all sorts of perversions that are just focusing on how do I just bring out the arousal side, the sensual side of sexuality. No matter about the moral side, no matter about the relational side, I just want to have an experience that's highly erotic. And really, you don't close any doors to try and get that. You
right.
use all sorts of means to promote that eroticism.
Because eroticism becomes an end in itself then. And like, as you say, that's the problem, is that if the whole point is to be as highly erotic as possible, then there are no boundaries. You know, whatever works to accomplish that is somehow deemed appropriate or necessary or good, which is so completely contrary to the biblical view of things, where there are boundaries that we live within as sexual beings based on what the purpose of my sexuality is, namely, to use this language in the context of commitment. One of the most obvious ways in which you see sensuality is at work is in this kind of gourmet attitude towards sexuality. If you were to go into some, you know, counterculture bookstore or something like that, and you'd get some kind of manual on sexuality that borrows a little bit from the Eastern sexual practices and talks about all the different kinds of positions and all the different kinds of props that you can use to basically enhance eroticism and pleasure, physical pleasure, heightened physical pleasure in a sexual encounter. Where is that coming from? Where that's coming from is what I want to use my sexuality for is for pleasure, period, pure and simple. I'm in pursuit of pleasure here. How do I get it? And how do I enhance it? And how do I get the most pleasure possible? That's just a completely wrong-headed way of thinking about sexuality. It's not only wrong-headed culture-wide in the sense that I don't know the boundaries of marriage. But the mistake that I saw Christian literature making back in the 70s is that it was kind of swallowing that whole picture and saying the way we Christianize this is we say, let's just bring it into the marriage relationship. And as long as this sensuality is confined within the context of my relationship with my wife or husband, then it's okay, right? Isn't that okay? So we would go, the idea is that you would go get those books at those bookstores, and you would bring those sexual practices and sexual techniques and sexual props into the marriage and pursue sensuality with your wife or husband in the context of the marriage.
And what I'm doing, Jack, is I'm pursuing sensuality. I'm pursuing eroticism. I am not pursuing loving my husband.
Exactly. That's the problem. That's the perversion.
And that's what's really the point here. We are not saying that pleasure is a bad thing.
No.
When I am pursuing loving my husband, I am very often going to have lots of pleasure in doing that. But the pursuing my husband is where I need to go, not toward eroticism.
And another symptom within the context of marriage that I am pursuing eroticism rather than the commitment and the relationship with your wife or husband is when there's a demand for greater and greater pleasure and demand for novelty, demand for experimentation. I'm in no position to say where to draw the line between when our sexual practices are just pure and simple sensuality, when they are perverse, when they are wrong, and when they're not. I'm in no position to say that. Everyone has to decide that for themselves, I think, before God. But what is clear to me is that there are certain sexual practices and certain attitudes towards sexuality that just are sensuality. Whether they're in marriage or not in marriage, they're just wrong. There are boundaries that we should not cross in terms of sexual techniques. There are goals that we should never set for ourselves within the context of marriage, because what we're after is heightened eroticism, not a relationship with the one I love. And they're wrong.
And what I'm doing is I'm just doing something only for me.
Right, right.
It's I've got my focus on how do I get pleasure, and basically what that boils down to, Jack, is how do I use you to get my pleasure?
Exactly.
And it's okay for me to demand it. If I think that eroticism is the end-all to sexuality, then if you're not giving it to me, then I can demand it. I'm thinking about a woman who wanted her husband to be involved in wearing certain items, certain kinds of clothing, when they were involved in being sexual together. And he just could not go along with that. She liked all sorts of different kind of items of clothing, and she liked to wear those, and she had a fantasy going in her mind about them, and she wanted her husband to join her. Well, finally she said, you know, if you don't do this, if you don't go along with me here, I want this so badly that I'm willing to leave you. And so he realized that it was really a turning point in their relationship, and either he had to bow down to doing these things with her, or she was going to leave him, and he did. He went and did these things. Now, to me, I think that's the saddest thing. That's so sad, because she wasn't saying, she wasn't looking at how do I love my husband. She wasn't looking at sexuality in the context of relationship. She was just saying, I want my needs met, and if I don't get them met, you know, I'm going to take my toys and go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you've put your finger on a large problem with sensuality, and that is how self-centered it is. It is just ultimately incredibly selfish. You can't both be committed to another person that you respect and value and objectify them into a object for my pleasure at the same time. Those are two completely incompatible frames of mind. And I can't have it both ways. Either my spouse is a human being, a full human being that I am to learn to know and respect, or she is a sex object, but I can't have her both at the same time. And we have to make a choice there. And there's really no choice when it comes to a Christian view of marriage. There's no question about what perspective we should have toward one another. My spouse is not a toy, is not a sex object. My spouse is a human being, a creature made by God that I need to learn to know and respect and understand.
So I'm going to bring up another area that I have found a lot in the literature. It's called sensate focus, and that's the kind of a technique that therapists use to help people understand and get in touch with their bodies and their how they can be aroused. On one hand, I think it's a very good tool that people can use to understand and have a sense of their own bodies, which lots of people have dampened over time, or don't have a sense of their own bodies, their own sexuality. They can't really bring their body into their relationship with their husband or wife because they have so dissociated from it. And so it's a good tool. On the other hand, Sensate Focus, which focuses on paying attention to your own responses, can end up being a tool of selfishness, where I'm just learning how to feel something in my body, and it's devoid very often of a context of relationship with my spouse. And so I think even that, which is a highly recommended tool that is in lots of literature, lots of sex therapists and therapists use across the country and probably throughout the world, it certainly does have some limitations, and I think it's just what we're talking about here. It helps people in some contexts to only become selfish if that's where it stops. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're saying, Jack, is sexuality, being sexual is really a relational thing. It doesn't just have to do with getting what I want when I want it and using you to get it.
Right.
Okay, so that's our definition of sensuality, basically. It's getting what I want when I want it and using you to get that for me. It's a form of selfishness.
Right.
Okay.
And, one of the characteristics, I think, of sensuality is that, like most pleasures in life, you see this as a phenomenon in drug addiction, for example. Like most pleasures in life, they grow old. You don't get as much jolt out of them as you are more familiar with them. And so what drives a culture into more and more perverse sexuality, kind of kinkier sexuality, that really ultimately knows no ends. I mean, I hear about some of the practices in some of the more promiscuous subcultures in our country, and it's just shocking to me. It's just astounding to me. I don't even know why they would find those sex practices interesting. From the standpoint of my own experience, intellectually I understand that. Intellectually I understand that when you're familiar with something and when you've used a sex technique or a sex practice, you've kind of used it up and you're not getting the same satisfaction from it. By satisfaction, I mean physical pleasure from it. Then you look for something new, something novel, something different that will, the novelty gives a kind of excitement to it and a jolt to it that makes it interesting to you. And then when you use that up, you go on to something else, and then you go on to something else, and you go on to something else. And what happens in a whole culture is the culture then becomes more and more and more perverse and kinky in its sexual practices. I think that's what we're seeing in our culture today.
And addicted to that.
Yeah, absolutely. An addiction.
But it seems like the biblical understanding of sexuality really takes that and turns it on its head, because as I become more and more committed to my husband, as I deepen my relationship with him, sexuality becomes less dry. It becomes more rich. It doesn't have to. I think there's a lot of people who don't have richness in their sexual life with their husband or wife. But if we are pursuing a relationship that over time does become richer and fuller, it very often follows that our sexual relationship will also become richer and fuller. So I don't have to look for kinkier practices. I have to look for deeper relationship.
Yeah, because is what you're suggesting, that the same sexual technique, you may be what other people would say, you're in a rut sexually in terms of your technique. But the reason I'm content to be in a rut is because it's deepening it in a different way, at a different level. That same sexual technique is being filled with more and more meaning from the context of my relationship. And that's where the real joy and pleasure is coming from, not from the adrenaline rush and the arousal and the high and the, just the pure raw physical pleasure.
Right. Although, technique, although I hate to think about it in that way, but ways of being sexual do change and are creative in the context of a relationship that has a lot of vulnerability and openness. I don't think it necessarily has to, but it seems to work that way, certainly for myself and some people that I've talked to, that creativity comes out of love. Creativity comes out of freedom. Creativity comes out of openness. And it isn't because I've had to try and be kinkier. It's because I am expressing in a deeper and deeper level my love for my husband.
Yeah.
And so it does change, and I don't need a bigger jolt from something outside. What I need is more and more internal depth and growth, both in myself and in my relationship with him. And that gives sexuality its meaning. And it is better now than it was, so much better now than it was 20 years ago. In fact, I think that our genital peak comes very early in our lives, especially for boys. What is it, around 19? For young women, it's mid-20s, possibly somewhere around there. It varies from person to person, but I don't think that's our genital peak, but that's certainly not our sexual peak. Our sexual peak, so to speak, comes in generations or decades, I guess, after we've been in a committed relationship with somebody. Sexuality becomes better as we grow older. And it doesn't matter that our bodies change, that our bodies aren't as firm or as beautiful as they used to be, or that we can be aroused as quickly as we used to be. Those things become inconsequential in the context of really being with somebody that we've loved for a lifetime and have this opportunity for connection through our bodies. That is just beautiful.
Yeah, I think maybe what you're suggesting is one way to describe the difference between what can happen in married sexuality and what happens in sensuality, even if the sensuality is in the context of marriage, is that sensuality is a kind of slavery, whereas what you're describing is a kind of spontaneity and freedom. And that those are really different. In terms of behaviors, they may at times overlap and look like they're the same thing, but they're not at all.
Well, they could look identical. If somebody was just looking at both, they could look identical. But you're saying it's slavery, and that I have a slavery to pursuing pleasure and having to almost kind of churn that out for my sense of adequacy or whatever reason people are doing it, as opposed to the freedom of expressing a love that already exists in an emotional way between the two of us.
Yeah. Because in married sexuality, when you have the substance of the relationship, sexuality simply reflects that. The sexuality may happen, it may not happen. It may happen tonight, it may not happen tonight. It doesn't have to happen because I've got the relationship. And that's the real substance of my satisfaction, of my fulfillment in my relationship with that woman. Whereas in sensuality, if you don't have the sex, you don't have nothing. If you don't have the sexual encounter, if you don't have the physical pleasure, if you don't have the sexual high, then there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And so you're in slavery to the passion itself drives you. I have to have this. I have to have this. As you said earlier, it's like an addiction.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying is I'm empty if I'm just addicted to sensuality and I haven't been developing a relationship. I'm pretty empty, and what I'm trying to do is just get some kind of connection. And I'm not getting connection through an emotionally developed, substantial, substantive relationship. I'm just getting it through skin-to-skin comfort. And I have to go back and get it more and more and more. Perhaps drive my spouse crazy with how much I want to get it, because I'm starving, so to speak, for connection with another person. And sexuality in that context doesn't make me less hungry. I get it, I'm feeling okay for a minute, and I've got to get it again. Where, on the other hand, with a relationship that is a substance and has been growing over time and has developed just a real maturity over time, I can be sexual and have a real deep feeling of satisfaction, augmentation of my relationship through being sexual. And I'm not as addicted to having to have it. What I already have is rich and full in my soul.
I started off by saying that there's two sorts of pleasures in sexual intimacy. One is the more physical, biological pleasure of arousal and orgasm and a sexual high, a physical high. But there's another one, and it's more subtle, and it's more difficult to talk about. It's more difficult to identify. But it's what we identify as being in love or romance or... It's that psychological pleasure that comes from being the most important person and being treasured by another person. And on the one hand, it's closer to, I think, what marriage really is and what it's all about and what is supposed to be substantively pleasurable about it, on the one hand. On the other hand, I think we can try to isolate that pleasure.
And pervert it also.
And I think that also is a form of sensuality that affects us deeply in our culture.
Okay, let's get straight here. There's one side that we were just talking about, this side, as opposed to this sensuality or just pursuing sexuality for my own selfish pleasure, for eroticism. And then there's this other side, which is relationship. But you're saying in this context of relationship, there's this other thing that can be perverted, and that is romanticism.
Right. Where it's not the relationship that we find fulfilling, but it's isolated, distilled out of that, the psychological pleasure of having someone treasure me. It's that feeling that I want, not the relationship.
Okay.
You see the distinction I'm making? The relationship...
It's not that the feeling is bad to have, that comes out of, that blossoms out of, or is like a fountain out of the relationship, that I feel good toward another person. You're saying it isn't really connected with the other person. It's like, as eroticism, it's just connected with me wanting to have another high.
Exactly.
It isn't from sexual arousal necessarily, but it's from this sense of romanticism where I'm the most special and important person, and it really doesn't come out of, it's not from the fountain of the relationship.
Yeah, exactly. See, sensuality comes from, is a word that describes wanting my senses to be impacted. And that's easy to see with respect to physical sexual eroticism. I just want my body to be stimulated. I want the pleasure. I want my senses to be impacted in a particular way. That's obvious to see and easy to define. This other one, it's not my senses, it's my mind, it's my emotions that are being stimulated. But there's a pleasure that comes from having someone love me and being in love with them. And I want that pleasure. Well, if I want that pleasure and that becomes a driving force in my life, it doesn't really matter if there's a real person on the other end of that. It doesn't really matter whether I have a real relationship with another person on the other end of that. Fantasy will do. You know, this doesn't have to do anything with reality. Just let me feel that pleasure. That is sensuality. I just want my inner senses to be impacted here. And whatever it takes to get that, I will do that.
This reminds me of something that a woman that I worked with once, and she was very, very confused about her sexual relationship with her husband, because on one hand, he was just very much pursued a relationship with her that felt, on one hand, to be very loving and caring toward her. He would light candles, take her on wonderful trips, buy her beautiful clothes that were pretty sensual, you know, kind of bring her out into the moonlight and be her Romeo, and she would be his Juliet. All of this was going on kind of almost like a movie screen. And she said, but, you know, I hate it. And this was exactly what was going on with him. He wasn't loving her to love her. He was using her as a means to get this strong feeling inside of him that he was pretty addicted to. It was a feeling of romanticism. And that's what he felt he had to have in his life, and he was just using his wife as a prop. She was very confused, because on one hand it seemed so generous. On the other hand, she was just so angry at him and couldn't figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Typically what we do in our culture is we look at physical pleasure, and we are prepared to say there's something base about that. There's something animalistic about that. There's something ugly about that. But this pleasure of romance, now that's noble, that's spiritual, that's transcendent, that's good, that's a good pleasure, and this other is evil. So your basic, probably, American sexual ethic is based on the assumption that animalistic sex is bad, romantic sex is good. So that love will justify virtually anything. You know, if two people are in love, then sex becomes okay, but casual sex, that's bad. One-night stands, anonymous sex, that's bad. But just let me be in love, and now that elevates sex up to its own level of being spiritual and pure and noble and right and good. What I'm saying is the biblical ethic cuts across that completely.
Before we go on,
okay.
Let me clarify what you're saying. You're not really saying these people are in love. You're saying that's kind of a little sarcastic. if I'm really in love, there will be in love. If I'm really committed to another person, if I'm really truly loving them, as God is wanting me to love somebody else, out of that comes sensual pleasure. Out of that may come a lot of romantic pleasure. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is, what we're talking about is people who are pursuing the eroticism in the same way that they're pursuing the romanticism. They're just doing it for themselves. The person who's pursuing the romanticism, however, is justifying it by saying, look, I'm in love with this person, so that justifies it. And the biblical perspective is, yeah, if you really are in love with somebody, these things can flow out of it, but let's not pretend that we're in love when really what's going on is I'm in selfish. I'm just trying to get my needs met. Am I following you, Jack?
Yes, I think so. I do think that there are whole experiences, both physically and psychically, that are just not going to be there in a really healthy marriage. That we pursue them out of sensuality only, and they really have no place in marriage.
Okay.
So, for example, in my marriage, you know, to simply for me to be a prop for my wife's romantic fantasies, there's no virtue in that. There's no reason for that.
For her to make you perhaps a character out of a novel,
right,
that is very enticing to her wouldn't be the right thing to do.
Right.
Rather than to let you be Jack.
Right. I mean, it comes back to what you were saying earlier about how willing we are to open the door to fantasy in our culture today. You know, in the literature that you were talking about.
Oh, it's very much encouraged.
Yeah, because it works. Well, it works to do what? It works to bring about pleasure, either a kind of psychical pleasure or a physical pleasure, or oftentimes there's an interplay between the two, both. But it works to bring about the pleasure. Never mind that there's no reality to it. Never mind that we're not talking about real life. Isn't the whole point pleasure? In the biblical ethic, the whole point is reality. Having a real relationship with a real human being that involves real commitment, real respect, real knowledge of the other person. And out of that grow all kinds of wonderful, rewarding emotions. I think that's the point that you were making, that we could call love. So am I in love with my wife? Sure, I'm in love with my wife. Am I infatuated with my wife? No. That would be, infatuation is the wrong sort of word to use to describe the profound, deep, real love that I have for my wife. Infatuation is more about fantasy than it is about reality. And yet, how many even Christian women would love to be infatuated again with their husband and are at one way or another encouraged to pursue that as a goal? You know, I shudder every time I go to a Christian bookstore and I see a title by a Christian author saying how to put the spark back in your marriage. Maybe it's okay. I'm not sure what they're saying in that book. Maybe it's just a really a bad way of describing a really good thing that they're trying to encourage. But as likely as not, it's a goal that Christians should never set for themselves. We shouldn't set as a goal to be infatuated with one another again. That was a very immature stage of our life that was out of touch with reality. We need to grow beyond that to something deeper and more profound.
Yes, yes. I too am really perplexed by that tendency, even in our Christian books, to say, how do you rekindle the spark? That's the way you put it. But rekindling the spark is really overlooking the work of relationship, and it's overlooking the depth that we can have in relationship. It's really, when I hear that, I'm thinking, oh no, you're really taking away from something that's much better. You're substituting it for something that's cheap. And but I have to come back to again, Jack, as I feel like I'm treading over this road so many times, but as I develop my relationship with my husband, as I really work to be open with him, to develop myself, to bring more of myself to the relationship, to look at and understand him and ask him to bring more to the relationship by my willingness to hear it and to be with him. As, you know, I'm just trying to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of relationship. As I do that, there is, it's not a spark like it was, you know, when I was a teenager, but it's a different, there's a spark in the sense of there's life. There's
a joy, a delight.
Yes, it's good. I want it. I seek it. I'm hungry for it. It's beautiful. I look forward to him coming home. I want to be with him. That kind of a spark has all sorts of value.
Sure.
But to try and generate that out of an empty relationship is something that's really empty. And I'm saddened by the emptiness that we're encouraging other people to pursue. It's out of our own emptiness that we write about this.
Yeah. And that's what sensuality is. It's replacing an empty pleasure for a deep, profound, joy-filled, delightful relationship. And that's wrong. It's just a completely wrong-headed approach to life and sexuality.
Jack, what if somebody's in a relationship and they just are not able to get what we're talking about here? They don't, on one hand, even get some empty sexual pleasure, sensuality, and they also don't really have much of a relationship. And they're sitting here thinking, well, couldn't it be that I'm not getting either? So what if I just leave this relationship and try something else? What if I have an affair? Because at least I have some experience of this sexuality, this good stuff that Jack and Christine are talking about. Or why don't I just leave my wife now or my husband now and get into a committed relationship that's better, just so that I can experience sexuality as God gave it? Don't I have a right to it if this is a gift God gave?
Well, actually, there are several questions there. Do I have a right to it? No. We don't have a right to any of the good gifts that life has to offer. They come to us as gifts. And if God gives it to us, great. If he doesn't, he has some reason. There, in his wisdom, he's deprived me of it because he wants to accomplish something, and it's something good that he wants to accomplish in my life. So we always need to be ready and willing to accept whatever deprivation God brings into my life. If he's denied me something, he's denied me something, and I need to be able to say, so be it. Okay, I accept that. That's a very, very important thing to learn. It's an important part of being a disciple of Jesus and a child of God, is to learn to say, whatever, you know, whatever you want me to have and whatever you want me to be denied of, Lord, I accept that. The other thing that we're losing sight of, if we're thinking that way, well, I'll just settle for second best because I don't have either first or second best, is that we have not been talking about an even more important thing than either sensual pleasure or a delightful, profound marriage relationship, healthy marriage relationship. There's something more important than both of those. And that is my own personal, individual righteousness and integrity before God. What is my life all about? What are the values that drive me? What do I think is important? What do I think my life is for? And the purpose of my life is to serve God, and to serve God by honoring the values of reality and the values of his kingdom. And therefore, if I can't honor those values and have a rewarding marriage relationship or sensual physical pleasure, then I need to go without both of them. Because it's far more important that it's going to be far more rewarding, really rewarding, for me to have that kind of integrity than for me to experience either of those two things. Now, a lot of people don't see it that way. They don't get it. They don't understand that that's what their existence is about. But I'm convinced that that's what the Bible is teaching us.
And without really understanding that that's what my existence is about, it really takes all this deprivation stuff and gives it no meaning at all. It gives suffering no meaning at all.
Right.
It gives paying a cost for something no meaning at all. I really have to understand the meaning of my existence to be able to put up with what life deals out to me, because life deals out some very, very difficult things.
That's really true. That's very important. If all of this suffering is just meaningless, then it's true. We ought to just go from one meaningless pleasure to the next, because there's nothing else. There's no other point to my existence. It's only when we really come to terms with who am I before God, and what is this all about, and where is he taking me, and why do I exist at all, and I become settled that the reason I exist is to serve him. The reason I exist is to be a reflection of his character and his values and his reality, to become a reflection of that, to become an embodiment of that. If I understand that that's the meaning of my existence, and that to learn to be that is more important than anything else in life, then I can see some meaning to my suffering. The suffering is to teach me to be wise, to teach me his values, to bring me to a point where I will own and embrace his values and inculcate them and make them the fabric of my own being. And suffering will do that in my life. Then my suffering and deprivation is meaningful. Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you. I think it's a good point, too. It is the very basis. That sounded pretty flippant, but really that's the very basis to everything that we're talking about
right here,
Jack, is, you know, I work with people. I was just talking to a group of women that I have worked with, I work with, and lots of them were talking about the cost that they're having to pay to really pursue what seems very, very right to them and very good to them. And I made the comment to them, you know, we would all look crazy in here to a whole lot of people because we're looking at and embracing suffering in our lives. And the reason we're doing that is because we want to pursue God. We want so much to have, we believe so much in the reality of what God says about himself and about life that we want it, and we're willing to go through the pain of growth. And that's really what it is. There is growth really requires a great deal of pain.
So in that regard, let me kind of, where the rubber meets the road is we live in a, I'm driving down the street and there's a song blaring at me on the radio where there's this very sensuous woman's female voice singing to someone about how much they crave their body, how much they want to be, how much they want to enjoy them physically and sexually. And I start comparing, what is this woman saying that she wants from that man, and what does my wife want from me? And there's a very critical moment there where I have to decide, am I going to allow myself to wallow in self-pity because they are speaking of a fantasy as if it were a reality and making it sound to me like the reality is a really good woman would really want to give a man everything that that man has ever dreamt of, sexually, physically, and romantically, and everything else. The real life experience of real people is that that never really happened. That never happens, at least not on the long haul. You know, it may happen for a night. It may happen for a weekend. You know, there are those moments where we play out our fantasies, but it cannot be sustained on the long haul for any real people. And in the end, there's no real substance and meaning to those relationships and to those encounters either. That they don't have that deep soil that you were talking about earlier of a real life commitment between real life people who are in every area of their life, in every dimension of their life, showing their valuing one another, respecting one another, showing their commitment to one another. There's no comparison really in the end between the substance of one for the other. And yet, I am sinful enough, I'm male enough, I am, I guess just those two things, I'm both male and sinful enough that woman's voice longing for that man is very alluring to me. And I have to get in touch with reality, and I have to make an important decision there. Jack, are you going to pity yourself because reality is not fantasy? Because reality cannot be the way the lyrics of that song are painting it? Or are you going to just accept the truth about what life has to offer, about what marriage really is, about what the real rewards of real marriage really are? Accept that from God and enjoy it and allow yourself to enjoy it. Or are you going to throw a temper tantrum here to God and say, God, we had a better idea about how to make human existence and sexuality, and you blew it because you didn't make it that way? And then on the same token, women have to face the same problem with respect to romance, I think. And life is not Bridges of Madison County or whatever else.
I was just thinking about that. So when you're talking about a temper tantrum, what that might not, it might not look like, stomping my feet and screaming. It might look like saying, you know what, I really am not getting what I want, and I'm just going to start listening to these songs more. I'm going to kind of get in my car and take long drives and listen to this alluring voice of this beautiful woman or this sexy voice of this man. I'm going to start kind of pursuing that in my life in ways that maybe other people can't see. My husband or wife can never really call me on it. But over time, I might slowly start to think that's really what's most important, and somehow I should be able to get that. And it's those small steps that eventually lead me toward being in a totally different relationship than what is right and good.
Yeah.
You know, so temper tantrums don't, I guess what I'm saying is they don't necessarily come in, you know, in a big, huge package. They could. You could turn around and you could go down to a place in town where, you know, prostitutes hang out and say, okay, it's my turn. It's finally my turn. So how does prostitution fit into all this, by the way, Jack?
Well, I think it's driven by a combination of economics and sensuality. For men, it's just sensuality, pure and simple. I just want pleasure. I don't want a relationship. I don't want to make a commitment. I don't want anything complicated. I just want physical pleasure, pure and simple, and I'll pay for it.
Okay. And I think it also, Jack, comes out of something that I think some people may be thinking as we're talking. They don't have a clue, perhaps, what we're talking about. What do you mean a substantive relationship? What do you mean a depth of relationship? I think certainly they understand the English language, but they don't have any idea about what we're talking about here. And so what's all that's left? They might have big question marks in their head. What else is left? What are you talking about? I feel pretty deeply connected to somebody, to a prostitute, when I'm with her. I don't know what you're talking about. And that's a really sad thing. So it's driven not just by economics and sensuality. It's also driven by our emptiness of our souls that have developed in our culture.
Yeah, that's true.
And to those people, Jack, I would say there is something more. It's out there to be pursued. With a cost, yes, but with a benefit, absolutely.
And the place to begin, I think people would make a mistake if they hear you saying it is out there. Okay, I just need to go find that woman then and have that relationship.
Oh, no, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know you're not. I've got to start with me. I have to become reoriented toward reality, toward God, toward the values that are important, toward integrity, in personal integrity. That's where I have to start. And that's the first step toward that kind of fulfilling marriage relationship one day.
Absolutely, and thank you for bringing that up. Because there's no way that I can enter into a sexual relationship with my husband or wife when I am a flat and devoid of life person. I don't have anything to bring. It is the paradox that in developing my own sense of identity, who I am, who God is in my life, I like your word integrity. As I have a person that's being built more and more in my life, then I can bring that into the context of a relationship. It doesn't matter who my husband or wife is. If I don't have that to bring to it, it's going to be a very lopsided and relationship that never does bring satisfaction in any way to me. And what I hear time and again is, if only my husband or wife would change, and I'm looking at a person who has no depth, no character, no sense of themselves, no understanding of what's valuable or good, or they don't have a sense of what their beliefs are, what their values are. They don't have a person, in a sense. They're just so devoid, like so empty, and they just want their husband or wife to change to make it better. It will never happen apart from their taking on the responsibility of confronting their own life, confronting their own self with the truth. And that's the same with single people. I hear so much, boy, my life would be all better if I just had a spouse. And I think, oh no, your life wouldn't be better. You would be more lonely than you ever were, because what you need to do is develop you before God in who He wants to make you to be. Pursue that with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. We need to go for that.
This program is produced by the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. The McKenzie Study Center was established in 1979 as a campus ministry near the University of Oregon. McKenzie offers classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. The heart of the Study Center teaching ministry is the Tuesday night lectures.
One of our classic Tuesday lecture series is Dr. Jack Crabtree's exposition of the Book of Romans. Other topics include marriage and sexuality, biblical interpretation, modern challenges to Christianity, and of course, the radical nature of the gospel. The Study Center also has numerous articles which may help many in their growth as Christians. For example, in her article, Pain and Glory, staff member Nancy Scott reveals her struggles with God when her mother was severely disabled with a major stroke, and what she learned from her mother's suffering, as well as her own. Or the article, In Praise of Manna, in which Dr. Crabtree examines Deuteronomy chapter 8 and the story of the manna in the wilderness as an illustration of how God uses suffering to humble his servants so they do not live for earthly delights, but rather the promises of God. All of the lectures and articles are available. Listen at the end of the program for information on how you can order tapes, articles, or a copy of this program.
All of our comments in this session were revolving around the topic of sensuality. This is in the larger context of what is a biblical sexual ethic. How would the Bible want us to employ our sexuality in our lives and behave ourselves and think about ourselves sexually? What I was suggesting today is that this thing called sensuality is one very important mistake that we can make with respect to our sexuality. Sensuality is making the mistake of thinking that pleasure, whether we're talking about physical sexual pleasure or even a kind of psychical sexual pleasure, that pleasure is an end in itself and that I am justified in pursuing the pleasure just for the sake of having the pleasure. From a biblical perspective, pleasure is there at both levels, both physically and psychically, in a sexual relationship. And there's certainly nothing wrong with it. It is a good thing. It is a gift from God. Is it a wonderful part of our human experience? But we pervert it if we take the pleasure that is really there and make that an end in itself, not just the byproduct of a different end that we are pursuing, namely a committed relationship with another man or woman. But we make the pleasure itself an end in itself. We make the pleasure an end in itself. When we do that, we're basically trading reality for a fantasy. Because to pursue the pleasure for its own sake, it doesn't have to be grounded in anything real. There doesn't have to be a real person on the other end of my relationship. I don't have to be really committed to them. I don't have to have a real knowledge and understanding for them. I don't have to have a real respect for them. I can just get either my body or my mind aroused into a state of some kind of psychical or physical pleasure, and that's all that matters. Whereas in a biblical sexual ethic, any pleasure that is there is growing out of the soil of a real relationship. A real person is there that I really know, I really respect, I really understand, and I'm really committed to. And that's real love. And in that context, pleasure is just sort of the byproduct and the wonderful, delightful byproduct of communicating with a person I love.
I think what we came to, Jack, and is that the underpinning of sensuality is selfishness. I'm only looking out for myself. I'm wanting what I want, and I'm trying to just use you to get it. And that's what makes it wrong. Sensuality, when it comes out of loving you, truly being committed to you, and with integrity, that pleasure can be a very legitimate part of our sexual relationship with one another, can be and is.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax-deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, The telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.